Figure Developer Podcast. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
And with us today we have Eric Negralis. Eric is a digital architect for Aperio Digital Studios, helping some of the world's largest brands and companies achieve their digital aspirations at scale through universal JavaScript and the cloud. Welcome, Eric.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
So Eric, thanks for coming on the show. Can you tell us about yourself?
Yeah, sure. My typical background story, origin story, if you want to call it that, I guess it's a pretty common tale among a lot of us in the industry. Had a computer in my face since I was five, introduced to a programming language. I think it was like GW Basic back in the day. I had an 8086 in my face. So that should tell you how old I am. But had programming languages and computers in my face since I was about 5-6 years old. Became a hobby, which now has become my full-time job. So I've been very fortunate to get into a field that actually was a childhood passion of mine. So I'm very, very happy to be doing what I love to do, as it were.
How long have you been programming professionally?
Yeah, so it's kind of a long, winding tale, I'd say, for my programming journey. So professionally, I've been doing applications development since, I want to say, 2003, so about 15 years now going on, which makes me feel really old, actually. But in terms of where I got my start, I really was in the .NET ecosystem to start professionally, which is kind of a dichotomy with what was being taught to be academically, because in academia, they would teach you a lot of the same higher level concepts using things like Java and C++. But when you go to professional, at the time I was doing some co-ops, these paid internships, I went to school in Drexel University in Philadelphia. So part of my curriculum was to do these paid internships as part of my undergrad. So interestingly enough, when you go out there in industry, at least in the Philadelphia area, it was predominantly .NET. So that was kind of weird where, to me, when I first got started out, that was a little weird where I was being taught one thing, but then I get to industry and the local industry was using something else. But it was a good learning experience. So .NET and Microsoft were my bread and butter for a while. So I started out from everything from VB.NET to Visual Basic for Applications, C# when it came out. I was there during the transition to .NET, pre-1.0. When we were still using things like Visual Studio, I guess it was 6, and things like Visual Basic for Applications, we were still rolling very procedural code. So it was a weird time to be in the Microsoft ecosystem because they were largely adopting the object-oriented design and principles of C# and even VB.NET. Even weirder to see the .NET ecosystem evolve from 1.0 to 2.0. So I was there through that entire evolution of .NET. And then from there, just basically rolled my Microsoft stack for the majority of my early part of my career. I got the data bug using SQL Server and BI because that was my concentration undergrad was actually data warehousing and business intelligence. So I was really into things like, you know, SQL Server analysis services, integration services, that sort of thing. So I had to scratch that BI bug for a while. So I was probably in the BI space for about, I want to say, 5 years. And then after that, I transitioned back over to web applications using ASP.NET MVC. I was using a little bit of Ruby on Rails on the side and C# as my primary development for a couple of years. And then kind of waxed and waned between BI and web app development. And then as hybrid platforms for mobile came out, started messing with that with Xamarin. And then finally, the latter part of my career into, I guess, what you can say is my present state is JavaScript. So I really got into JavaScript, I want to say, right around about 2 or 3 years after Node came out. Node came out like around 2009. It was a bit of a curiosity. And I'm sure all of us, all developers are like, wait a minute, server-side JavaScript? The hell are you talking about? So it was a bit of a curiosity. And then after a lot of use cases proved it out, And then you saw the value in it. That's when I kind of hopped on the train. And then the story tells itself after that. JavaScript has made numerous evolutions since then. Since about 2011, we've gone from a really gross sort of syntax into something a little more professional, grade with ES6 and TypeScript if you're in that sort of thing. And we've gone through so many frameworks that I'm sure you guys have discussed framework and JavaScript fatigue on this podcast, as many podcasts have. And here we are at the current state of JavaScript, where we're rolling Node.js in the back end, GraphQL, which we'll talk about today, and the React ecosystem for being React Native. So really kind of made all the rounds, if you want to summarize it.
Yeah, that's quite a journey.
Yeah, very circuitous, right?
Hold on, let me look up that word.
Your bio, which we'll post complete bio in the show notes, says that you're an advocate of universal JavaScript, Heroku, and AWS. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about what universal JavaScript is and how you got involved in the types of things that you're playing with these days?
Yeah, sure. So the whole concept of universal JavaScript is actually a less gross version, a less buzzwordy version of what you call isomorphic JavaScript. You know, you go online, you go on Twitter, and you see people talking about isomorphic JavaScript. And I think a lot of new technologists actually get intimidated by it because it's such a very complicated sounding term. But really, all it really means is that I am coding the exact same way on the front end as I am in the back end. Traditionally speaking, at least in the web app space, you'd always have to be what they called another gross term, another gross buzzwordy term, a polyglot, right? You had to be able to develop in multiple languages, be it CSS, HTML, some kind of arbitrary templating syntax on HTML on top of the C# you were coding, or the Ruby or the Java you were coding. So it's always been this kind of separation. It was separating concerns, but also separating jobs, if you want, right? So you always had somebody who was specializing maybe in two of those four types of technologies, and then you'd have front end, back end developers. So you'd have almost like an assembly line, right? So traditionally in the past, you'd have, okay, we'll have to wait for the back end developers to finish their work, or we're waiting our front end developers to finish their work. It was highly specialized. So because JavaScript ended up growing up, and ironically, of all things, JavaScript was one to unify all these things, because if you had asked me that this would be the unifying language back in 2010, I would tell you you're completely out of your mind. It is the grossest language I've ever seen. But here we are, right? Here we are, and it's in its current evolution, where it's actually a professional grade language. But you know, it's basically being able to code the same way in the front end and the back end, which lends very obvious operational advantages, right? So instead of having kind of like this siloed work, you then have all of your developers, all of your architects sort of thinking in the same fashion and being able to kind of plug and play, theoretically plug and play into different parts of the application development stack relatively easier to times in the past. So really, that's what really drew me to universal JavaScript. This whole concept of a unified language is being able to solve problems on a common ground and being able to be efficient. Because don't get me wrong, I mean, you know, I can be a programming language nerd and a purist some days when I'm like, wow, that's pretty gross syntax right there. I'd rather write it in this fashion. But at the end of the day, I try to balance that with being able to deliver value for my clients and my stakeholders, because that's part of the thrill too, right? That's equal parts of the thrill is the craft itself, obviously, but also being able to deliver in a timely fashion. By being able to develop things on a universal platform like JavaScript and being able to increase your team's velocity, you're then exposed to more interesting problems. You then get to solve more problems at a higher rate. And you basically level up way faster than you normally would if you just specialize in one particular type of tech that only boxed you in certain types of problems, if that makes any sense. I specialize in Heroku and AWS, but Azure does this as well, and also a lot of cloud providers. Being able to have computing as a commodity and not having to need a team to manage data centers for you, or not having to have such huge depth of knowledge and infrastructure, and just having developers say, here is my application code, just run it and have it scale out automatically. That's very powerful, right? That kind of gives even an individual developer or a small team the capabilities they wouldn't have had in the past. In the past, the barrier to entry for all this wonderful scaled out computing was, you know, being able to be rich enough to have these massive data centers. But now you've got cloud computing where you're only paying for what you use. I mean, it's fantastic now. And those two paired up together, you know, the velocity of universal JavaScript and the lower barrier to entry of the cloud of solutions like Heroku, AWS, and Azure. I think it's a super exciting time right now to be a technologist, because literally the only thing limiting a technologist from putting an amazing digital product out there and making a really good living for yourself is your imagination.
I saw that you were doing a lot of writing on GraphQL recently. Do you want to tell us how you got interested in that, and maybe back up a step further and explain to our audience what GraphQL is?
Sure. So GraphQL is really a style of architecture to write specific web to write web services. If your audience has done a little bit of reading on web services, you'll know that it's kind of gone through different evolutions, right? So back when I started my career, web services were predominantly written in XML and this thing called SOAP, Simple Object Access Protocol. And I can see some of you guys twitching right now with PTSD. But anyways, as you guys have already alluded to, SOAP is not exactly the easiest thing to work with. So early web services kind of went through that iteration where they were trying to solve the problem of having a common language that systems will have to talk to each other, right? Because when the internet age came out, it basically unchained all of the systems within the data centers. You don't have to rely on just the resources your company could provide anymore, or you're just siloed into a specific set of servers. You're now kind of interconnected. So when you have interconnected systems, you need a common language in which they talk. And SOAP was kind of like the first stab at it. Fast forward a couple of years, we're now into the current predominant way to build web services, which is REST. So that's basically swinging the pendulum the other way. So whereas SOAP was more command and control, you must have this specific contract or you can't talk to me. REST is more, I joke around that REST is like pirate's code, right? It's like a set of guidelines as to how to implement web services. And that comes with its benefits, right? You get the maximum flexibility. You have a language that it talks on, the JSON, JavaScript Object Notation, which is a bit easier to read than XML. It's a bit more terse. It's not so heavy, so that it's just huge network traffic bouncing back and forth from each other. It's a little more easy. It's a little easier to decipher. The problem with it, the pendulum swinging to that way, where it's more pirate's code, is that you now have variances in how web services are kind of implemented, right? We had a joke with my coworkers when I said, okay, show of hands, for those of you who think they interface with REST services, how many of them are actually REST services to the T, to the spec? And honestly, most people are like, oh yeah, you know what? Most of these are kind of just like JSON APIs over HTTP. And I'm like, yeah, that's exactly the problem. It's too open. Being open in and of itself is not the problem. But if you don't have a consistent approach, then you have fragmentation, right? So we're kind of back to where we started. It's a bit better than SOAP, where it's not so rigid. It's easier to bind to. But now you have the problems of fragmentation of how to implement these services. You have the problems that we see with distributed systems, right? Where you don't know what types of data you're getting back from the server, something as simple as that. Or you don't even know how to talk to a server without consulting with a huge API documentation. That seems to be the current state of implementing web services now. So GraphQL, taking it now to the current state where, you know, the architecture du jour, if you will, is GraphQL, which kind of borrows elements from both sides of the fence, where it has the ability for you to inspect what you can integrate with the way SOAP did, because of the structure that it has. You can basically ask a GraphQL server, hey, what sorts of data can it query from you? And what sorts of things can I do to mutate that data? And can I do real-time subscriptions, that sort of thing? So you can actually interrogate a GraphQL server and it'll tell you what you can integrate with. And it gives you a standard querying language to talk to it instead of just using straight HTTP bodies and these kind of arbitrary constructs that you normally see in REST services. The way you describe it, it's kind of like a Goldilocks zone of web services, right? It's not too much command and control where it's preventing me from iterating quickly, but it's also not so wide open that we develop anti-patterns quickly. It's kind of that in between.
I've exposed some OData querying through controllers and things like that before. Is it a similar concept that you can construct a query on the front end and kind of pass it through or?
Yep, that's exactly it. So it's kind of, it's same thing as concept as OData, right? So the whole concept of remote procedure calls, right? So for folks who aren't familiar with remote procedure calls, it's just a fancy term of saying that we're treating a distributed system as if it were one system. We're treating something remotely as if it were a local resource. So you don't really care for how you connect to it. All you want to know is here's the data that I want, or here's the operation that I want, go execute it and come back with something. So it's very similar. So it's very similar to OData in that fashion where it is a standard querying language to do specific operations, and it's strongly typed. So you can basically construct your data schemas on your client side with a bit more confidence than you would with just an open REST API.
How difficult is it to use? So like if, I guess from a client side, JavaScript perspective, and from a backend .NET or Java or Ruby perspective, how difficult is it to get set up and get to actually making queries?
It's not terribly difficult, surprisingly. So this is one of the things that is the value proposition for GraphQL, because if you dive into the implementation of what a GraphQL server is, it's really just a tree of functions, a tree of linked functions. So basically, when you construct a GraphQL server, there's really two things you need to consider. One is the different types of things that you're going to expose to whatever is going to integrate with. And second is the actual implementation. So if you want to make it a C# analogy, you can think of the types as the interfaces to specific implementations, and then the resolvers are the actual concretions to those, to the what. So it's the what and the how, right? That's all it is. So the effort needed to construct that, I would say, is arguably only a little bit more difficult than trying to adhere to RESTful standards using whatever it is, MVC, using event sourcing, whatever your flavor is for constructing RESTful endpoints. That's the nice part, is that it's not that much more difficult than you would expect to implement a web service. Plus, you get a bunch of wins with it because the ecosystem around GraphQL has made it easy to connect these servers to every front-end framework imaginable, from React to Angular to Vue to anything you can imagine, and also comes with a lot of batteries included on the client side as it pertains to stuff like caching and real-time notifications. Two items on the front end that I'm sure you guys know are not very trivial to implement. The value proposition is you can write your service in this fashion. It's only slightly more complicated than writing a RESTful service, and you get a lot of batteries included with it if you want it.
Are there any security concerns with opening up this kind of functionality on a client per se?
Not necessarily, because a lot of the security mechanisms that you would bake into GraphQL are really a lot of the security mechanisms you'd already bake into a straight up RESTful service. So things that have been adopted lately are this whole concept of stateless token authentication, right? That sort of thing. You can reuse that if you want, because GraphQL still has knowledge of what you're passing over the wire in terms of your headers. You can even use cookies if you want to go that deeply. You can use sessions to that level. So that is the nice part about GraphQL, is it doesn't actually aim to replace your entire existing web stack. It only aims to augment it or give you a better layer, a better abstraction layer for querying services.
It's interesting. I mean, I guess I can kind of see the value proposition that you're kind of putting out here is GraphQL is giving you, with a margin amount of extra effort, you get something that is going to kind of be and be a little bit more constricting, right? But because of that, you get the benefit of having things more consistent and uniform, and that lets you kind of save time elsewhere, which kind of gives you back that effort and gives you back that time, because you're going to save it through not having to redevelop extra functionality. You might even get, like you're saying, some of that kind of right out of the box with other tools that other people have already put together. I really think that the idea of using this as kind of like a front end or like a catch for all of these microservices or something like that kind of is very intriguing to me.
Definitely. And the thing is too, with GraphQL, and this is just for posterity's sake, for folks who aren't on your call that aren't familiar with some of the architecture, some of the competitor architectures, this isn't like a new concept, right? Kind of like how React was not a new concept, kind of like Angular was not a new concept, MVC was not a new concept. There are already competitors out there to GraphQL to kind of take the mantle of this, you know, the unified way to talk to services over the web. The most notable of which, and I think, John, you put that on the description, was Falcor, right? So Netflix created this thing called Falcor and obviously OData. The thing is, though, it's kind of interesting as to how GraphQL kind of got the hype, right? Because now people are really talking about GraphQL. I think I'd say in the last half year, I've been getting a lot of asks for it, a lot of interest in it. And it's interesting because it's really been driven. Initially, it was a front-end driven thing. It was something that was going to make life easier, make the dynamic between front-end and back-end a little smoother, right? Because it was basically going to be a querying language. Think of it from the perspective of front-end versus back-end developer, because that's always a dynamic that you work with, right? Typically speaking, you always have that line demarcation. You have a front-end developer that might be a bit faster in implementing a bunch of the templates, a bunch of your UI than your back-end, or vice versa. The back-end might race ahead of your front-end. But before, it was always like, all right, well, I mean, here's a RESTful endpoint that we might implement. We might change it later because, you know, X, Y, and Z, because the requirement changed or the domain language changed, that sort of thing. And then the dynamic would be a lot of friction between front end and back end, right? Whereas now when you have a standard querying language versus implementation, you don't have to worry about a lot of boilerplate between your front end and back end. Now it's just literally going from front end to back end saying, hey, so this is going to be the query we're going to pass to you, or here are the set of queries that we're going to pass to you. Can you provide us results of these? And it's okay if you're not done. We can just consume it. We can mock this stuff in the meantime. But now we have a standard way to talk. So it gave a common language between front end and back end. So that I found that interesting because that's really where the hype came from for GraphQL, is that the front end was like, this is amazing. This is an amazing new tool. That's making us a better development team. So it's really driven down from the React ecosystem, right? It's kind of like it's almost like a perfect feedback loop where React got popular, tools around it got popular, and then approaches around how to do React UIs became popular. This is one of those things where it was almost a side effect of React being popular, is that, hey, we're using this tool called GraphQL that makes life easier for front-end and back-end developers. And then when you dive into it, you're like, oh, wow, look at that. It's not really tied down to anything. It's not tied down to a database. It's just a specific approach to write web services. And it could be a front for a distributed architecture. And that was never its intent, right? The original intent was probably just to make life easier for front-end and back-end developers. And here we are having use cases for it that have really profound effects. There's a lot of companies out there that have used GraphQL to great effect. GitHub has released their latest version of their API. REST is gone. It's basically GraphQL. The one big use case that came out last year was the New York Times. One of the benefits of GraphQL, and I didn't really touch on this, was that you can send a specific query to your server and get the exact data that you want that might otherwise take multiple round trips on a REST service, right? So think about how RESTful resources are constructed. I'm going to get a user object. I'm going to get their friends. I'm going to get their comments. I'm going to get whatever it is, everything that's related to that user, and it's multiple round trips. That doesn't seem like a big deal for a smaller application, but when you're the New York Times and you're serving up millions of requests, even a 10% improvement can have a profound effect because of the scale they're at, let alone what they've had right now, where basically they're just using GraphQL to efficiently assemble data for all their consumers. And it's closer to more like a 70% reduction in network traffic, because now you just have, you know, clients saying, here's the data that I want, give it back to me, versus, you know, five requests, six requests just to assemble the data plus all the boilerplate. So that's super powerful. It doesn't seem like a big deal, but then you look at it at scale and you realize, wow, that's, if you think about that at scale, it's kind of a big deal.
The clients and companies that have been inquiring about GraphQL, are they the types of clients that are really making an investment in technology, or what are the common traits that you might see from those that are adopting GraphQL?
I would say the common traits are, as you alluded to, there is an acknowledgement in the investment in technology. So there's a lot of awareness, because again, GraphQL is kind of a very new thing, right? You have to kind of have somebody inside your team that's been working with newish type systems and kind of already pitching the value proposition of it before they even come asking for it. So yeah, so typically the companies you see that are asking for it are ones that are already kind of technologically minded and have a strong technical team internally that have kind of done a little bit of the grassroots of it, but they just want to take a deeper dive into it. I think we're at the phase right now with GraphQL. I'd say it's probably going to, if this becomes the standard for how web services are going to be written, it's probably going to take at least another year or two for it to become as ubiquitous as, you know, RESTful services. You know, everybody knows RESTful services, no matter your skill level. But I think it's going to take a year or two for it to be ubiquitous in the technological language versus now where it's like you have strong technical teams pitching for it because they see the benefit of it. It's not, I guess a lot of people are still waiting on these studies like the New York Times, like GitHub, like Facebook to show the benefits of it.
It seems like part of the, you know, solution or thing, some of the things that it's kind of fixing is the failures, not actually of REST, but people's abilities to implement REST. Maybe that is part of REST's failures because it's not so, you know, confining or prescriptive, right? But I mean, how many RESTful services actually have hypertext? You should be able to query them and they should be able to give you a listing of the options that you have, but that it's so rare to be seen. You know, there are kind of other things. I think like even like the round trips of having, you know, having to make all these different calls. I mean, maybe with a microservices architecture, you might end up having to do that, but there's certainly plenty of opportunities to roll one API in front of all these things. If you know that these things are actually cohesive, you could easily write one RESTful service that gave you all of those things and then gathered them all up from the different microservices that you had. So it's, you know, it's kind of like it seems to me like there is the opportunity to solve the problem is there, and the framework and those things are kind of definitely there. But you know, with something like the GraphQL being a little bit more prescriptive and not letting people kind of have the freedom to go their own you know, transgressive way, you know, is kind of what maybe is the strength of it.
Yeah, definitely. And to your point too about you know, the kind of shortcomings, any shortcomings of REST, I think the whole concept of dynamically just getting the data that you need, like to your point, most RESTful services should be able to do this anyway. I should be able to pass in query parameters and get the data that I need. But again, it is open. It is just an approach. It's a guideline. So you never see that across the board. So maybe it does take something like a GraphQL or something like this to be like, all right, you can play, here's the sandbox you can play in, you know, right. Be as creative to your heart's contentment in the resolvers. But when you talk to anything external, here's how you talk to them externally and just adhere to this. I mean, it's nice to have these different options like GraphQL, like REST. Right now, I think that we're now evolving in a time where it's basically we're trying to solve the whole concept of disconnected state between client and server. So all these different tools are really just to kind of mitigate that. That's really the grand scheme of things of why things like GraphQL pop up, is just to make things easier for you to sync up with a server.
Do you have any words of wisdom to kind of give out to those who might be just starting out trying to seek that six-figure dev position?
I would say that the main things that have been constant in my career are mainly just never letting anything take the joy of the craft away from you. You'll run into these projects where they seem soul-sucking, and you just kind of have to think to yourself, this is going to pass too. This is just temporary. And number two is just being able to communicate well with other developers and letting them teach you as you can teach them. There's this really bad stereotype of the typical developer just locked in our cubicle or office, just hacking away 8 hours a day. You know, the typical thing, right? I think that's not very constructive to new developers starting out, because they have this expectation of maybe that's what I ought to be doing. If you look at the developers today, and if you follow even some of the giants in our industry on Twitter, a lot of them are on GitHub. A lot of them are just asking questions same as you. And when you meet them in person in conferences, they're very, very normal people. So the key there is to always have that feedback loop with others, to know that, you know, this is a craft where the predominant trait, the predominant action we run into in our craft is we fail, right? We keep failing until we succeed. To be successful in that kind of environment, it's always conducive to seek out the help of others and also give help when others seek it too. I think it's very important to give back to the community in whatever capacity it is.
Awesome. Thanks.
Do you have any upcoming speaking engagements or anything that's going on in your social calendar that you might want to let our audience know about?
Yeah, sure. So one speaking engagement that I have committed to is at Orlando Code Camp on March 17th. I believe that's a Saturday over at Seminole State College. So I'll be talking more GraphQL in depth. I'll actually be diving into how to implement a GraphQL server. What are the basic constructs of a GraphQL server, and showing folks that it's really not that much more effort to implement it versus a REST service. So if you're in the Orlando area, Seminole State College, Saturday, March 17th, they haven't announced the times yet, but it's going to be an all-day thing. That's the Orlando.net group's code camp, their annual code camp. So if you want to learn more about GraphQL, come out and see me.
All right, Eric, how should people get in touch with you if they would like to reach out?
Sure. So to reach out to me, I'd say Twitter would probably be the best medium. So just direct message me or tweet at me. My Twitter handle is Grales, G-R-A-L-E-S. Secondary, I'm on GitHub. Just look for Eric Nagrales, all one word. I've got a couple of libraries out there that I've written for some people, just a bunch of utility libraries. So you could reach me there. Finally, all else fails, shoot me an email, grales@gmail.com, grales@gmail.com.
All right, Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
That was Eric Nagrales. Eric is a digital architect for Aperio Digital Studios, helping some of the world's largest brands and companies achieve their digital aspirations at scale through universal JavaScript and the cloud. This has been the Six Figure Developer Podcast. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.